Hey, health junkies. It's time for The Health Fix. Join your host, Dr. Janine Krause, as she gives you a dose of what you need to know and do right now to take control of your health from the inside out, to rebel against aging, look damn good, fight stress, and laugh every day.
Hello there, health junkies. Welcome to another episode of The Health Fix. I'm your host, Dr. Janine Krause. Today, I have a pal of mine with me here. We're going to be doing an in-person interview, which is always exciting for me. His name is Michael Yajic. He is the host of the Tree Hugger podcast, and we are going to be talking all about the environment, how it impacts you, and also this concept of gut bugs and how is it really a good idea to be wiping them all out and trying to clean these clear slates? Maybe we should be thinking a little bit more about our guts as ecosystems. So without any further ado, Michael, say hello.
Hi.
There
Thanks
he is.
For having me. Appreciate it.
No problem. So hey, let's talk first about what everyone thinks about in terms of green spaces, because you know, a lot of talk out there, like we need to get in touch with our environment. We need to get in touch with our universe a little bit more, and all these concrete jungles are not doing us any favors. So in terms of these green spaces, what have you found in your job as a plant ecologist for the city of Seattle? What have you found to be the most effective in terms of your guys' work there?
Oh, for my work. So we work over a broad range of different size green spaces because the city of Seattle has acquired or inherited different parks for different reasons. Sometimes they're little small places that people have donated. Other times they've gone after grant funding to buy like large tracts of land. Particularly, we have a lot of steep slopes and wetlands that I guess at one point were technically not developable, even though I think the technology is advanced and engineers are out there that can build pretty much on anything. But yeah, we have essentially 6,000 some odd acres, and it really varies between 2,700 acres of green space, which we think of like are largely forested, but then also there's the playgrounds, the ball fields, the shorelines, the pools, the rec centers, things like that. So the Parks and Recreation Department is, yeah, it's pretty varied in the land it owns and the facilities.
Okay, so now that we've got the idea of what a green space is, what would folks be looking at in terms of the most beneficial for their mind in terms of a green space? What are we seeing out there as the most beneficial spots?
Right. So I think with parks, and obviously I think about urban areas, and perhaps most of your listeners are urban dwellers. So we think about what people go to parks for, and a lot of that thing is recreation, right? So we recreate. We're either biking or swimming or hiking or picnicking in the grass. Or in my case, the volunteers that I work with, we're planting, you know, killing weeds and planting trees. So in my mind, you know, being an ecologist and being in tune with like biodiversity, generally, I think the research that's out there and what's backed up in my observations too is that generally the more diverse areas, botanically, with, you know, the more varied natural native vegetation is the best in my mind. But there's a lot to be said for blue space as well. So a lot of research about just the importance of water. And I think the research about water is fairly underfunded across the board. So there's a lot to be said for people who just feel best, you know, along the shores of Puget Sound or near the ocean or near lakes too.
Spaces. I think a lot of people think about going to the water to chill out. You'll often see people sitting in their cars, unfortunately, staring out at the water. I wish they were out and kind of breathing the air and just kind of interacting with the environment a little bit more. But I can see how the plants that we have in that particular environment, the air that we breathe in that particular environment can make a huge impact. As we know, there's certain plants that more or less are going to clean the air, correct?
Oh, of course. Yeah, there's, I think just structurally, physically, like if there's a green space that's adjacent to an area of like an arterial road where a lot of vehicles drive, like that, those trees and the vegetation catch the particulate matter. So in that way, it cleans the air in the urban environment, as well as just in the act of photosynthesis, creating clean oxygen, the negative ions, I think, as well, just add to that general milieu of kind of a healthy environment.
I love that. Because, I mean, it seems like green spaces, blue spaces, what we ultimately look at is their cortisol lowering, probably cholesterol lowering too, because we're probably out moving, breathing, relaxing a little bit more. But a lot of the research, and you and I were talking about this before, that cortisol is being lowered when we're out in green and blue spaces. Now, it seems that the research is trending even deeper than that cortisol in terms of its effect on the body. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I think from some of the forest bathing research that I've read, and this is one that's generally it's touted across the board for how the environment affects our health, is that it decreases stress. But it's like, what's the actual mechanism? And I think the mechanism is like cortisol lowers. So research from like Japan and Korea, they've measured cortisol like before and after, or I'll walk through the woods for as short as like 20 minutes shows that cortisol lowers. So that's one of the mechanisms, as well, just self-reported, feelings of well-being before and after a walk through the woods, has been measured, as well as like the, it boosts natural killer T cells, mm-hmm. which I think is, perhaps a function of these like phytoncides or terpenes, which are like the forest aerosols, which you smell in the air, like as you walk through the woods. So particularly conifers. Mm-hmm. So there's these terpenes like this limonene, I think I'm saying it right, which is that like Lysol smell.
Yeah, that piney scent you get when you walking through.
Right, so and then alpha pinene as well. So these are the kind of natural chemicals produced by the trees that were either originated as like a defense or as a way to attract pollinators. So that is, still at play today. And that's what you're breathing, and that's what's been measured to lower these, to boost these natural killer T cells. So, so there was like a study looking at like a 3-day retreat of people. So that's similar to like us going camping, I guess, maybe, and just like kicking back, being in the green space, being in the park, and then going home. And some of those benefits last for like 30 days.
That is awesome.
Right.
So like garden huffing, implant huffing. When I get out to Colorado, there's this certain area where I used to live where it just smelled so strong of pine, and I would stand out there and be like and try to suck it in and hold it in. So now I know that each time I'm there, maybe it can last me 30 days.
It lasts for a while. So you get the frequency at which you go, mm-hmm. and like take part in nature, and then the duration. I think always people are busy, so they're always trying to figure out, like, how much do I need, right? So regardless of, like, whether or not it feels good, you want to spend, you know, as much time as you want there, or if you're a really busy person, you know, like, I just need 20 minutes, like, I would say get your dose in every day.
Love it.
Yeah, and so if it's in, you know, and if it's in your backyard, if it's in your garden, that's perfect. Like you don't even have to drive to get there or walk to get there. But yeah, bigger parks, like honestly, my sense of place is in the Pacific Northwest in the forest. So that's where I feel most at home. Other people might be, like I said, it might be the desert and wide open spaces, or it might be this place in Colorado you're talking about, or it might be near some waterfalls. So, but I'd say whatever feels good, there's probably something described by science or something that we can't describe by science that's like attracting us to these spaces.
Well, absolutely. We all know how we feel when we get outdoors. I mean, most of us who have outdoor let's say, tendencies. You are an ultra marathoner. I love to just hike. I like to run. Definitely not in the category of ultra marathon, but I just like being outside. And so I think a lot of people who like to be outside, they get a little bit of an endorphin hit in addition to these benefits from the terpenes and possibly whatever else we might be inhaling from the environment, which leads me to my next question about the microbes that are out there, because a lot of people have been hearing all the data on take your soil microbes, take your, you know, plant-based probiotics, if you will. And a lot of people ask me in my practice, like, why would I want to have soil-based probiotics versus other things? So can you speak a little bit to what we're starting to find out about being outdoors and getting a hold of some more soil-based organisms?
I think so. So, so I think there's that rush that's from walking through the woods or gardening that's different than ultramarathoning, I guess, right? So there's, so I think from my plant ecologist perspective, like I know way more about soil microbes than anything else, and not particularly in regards to human health, but for as far as the diversity of soil microbes in the soil, like just one teaspoon of soil has as many organisms as there are people on the earth.
What?
Yeah, like major biodiversity is housed in the soil. So you think of biodiversity and like kind of the worldwide biodiversity of how many organisms there are on earth, and then kind of scale down. And probably as you scale down, we know less and less and less. And like, and microbes are invisible, right? But through different technologies like culturing or molecular technologies or now genomic technologies, people, scientists and researchers have found out more about the soil microbiome. So there's different species, I guess phyla even, that live on the surfaces of the leaves. Again, talking about plants. And then as well around, we call so that's like the phyllosphere, I guess it's recalled. And then the rhizosphere, which is the soil like immediately surrounding and adjacent to the roots. So the bacteria are particularly underground in the rhizosphere are attracted to those kind of the tips of the roots, really. So where the root exudates come out.
Okay.
And that's really like where the photosynthate comes out. And the roots use it to essentially, they've evolved together to attract bacteria, and the bacteria feed on those root exudates.
That's really cool.
Yeah, and so there's even fungi that probably help plants evolve, you know, millions of years ago, called mycorrhizal fungi, right? That either cover the tips of the roots or inside the roots or even inside the cells of the roots that help the, so in exchange for carbohydrates, the fungi helped uptake nutrients and water and to a certain extent help communicate underground between organisms as well.
That's really awesome. I mean, we have quite highly intelligent system. What it makes me think about is when I was a kid, because you're saying one teaspoon of dirt. I used to make dirt pies, and I swear I probably ate a lot more dirt than my mom wanted me to. So what you're saying is, for those folks out there who have kids in particular, let them get dirty. Let them roll around in the dirt. If they make a dirt pie within reason, go for it.
Yeah, I think so. I agree. I was in a meeting recently talking about bloodborne pathogens. At the city of Seattle, and really in particular, like viruses, I guess they're different, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you probably from your studies or time in school probably learned and probably have seen like the outcome of how viruses gone wild, and even there's poor bacteria too. But I think in the kind of more human environment, we may come in contact with these things that can hurt us or pathogens. But generally, we Lysol can't get rid of everything, and we can't, we have some semblance of control, but we think of this hygiene hypothesis that, you know, we need to sterilize everything to keep things clean, to keep us healthy. really with recent research, it's like kind of a farce to a certain extent. But I think in a healthy soils, if you're out, getting outside is important. Healthy soils, the more you know about those soils, I think is more important, because you can't, and the one caveat being in the urban green spaces, we do live with this legacy of pollution.
Yes.
Right? So there are, I'm not saying you never have to wash your hands, like never have to wash your hands again, but really we've supported some research in Seattle where environmental scientists looked at heavy metals in the moss as well as in the soils adjacent to some of the major, like Interstate 5 and some major arterials, and found a lot of heavy metals associated with the transportation sector, right? So I'd say, like, as far as you can get away from the transportation sector, right? Like, deep into the woods are probably where you find the most healthy soils, particularly, too. And then, too, if you're gardening and you're digging in the dirt and you know where that soil came from, you know what you've added to that soil, then you can feel rest assured that those are the kind of the healthier microbes, kind of more beneficial or neutral microbes that you're coming in contact with.
Thanks for that explanation. I think that, you know, clarifies in terms of, yeah, dirt's good, but you want to be looking at less tainted dirt, essentially. If you live in the Seattle-Tacoma area, we've got a lot of pollutants, unfortunately. If you live, say, in Whitefish, Montana, you might, you know, play around in the dirt a little bit more in that aspect. And it is good that you mentioned in terms of gardening, because I think a lot of people are doing more of their own compost, things of that nature, which is great, but if you're picking up a compost from some outside source that you don't know what's all in that, probably not a good idea to be licking your fingers after gardening.
Of course, right. But you're in there, but you're not just digging in the soil. And so there's airborne, things are become airborne as you're digging. So you're breathing it in. So I think, and you probably know better than me, the microbes like in your airways are probably different than the ones that inhabit your gut. They're different than the ones that inhabit your skin. They're different than the ones that live best in the soil. So, yeah, I think as well, like, so eating nutritious food as well. So this food that comes out of your garden, it's probably, regardless of how much you wash, right? You're like we're always trained, have been trained, I think, to wash vegetables like crazy. And there's even these products to like disinfect things before you eat them, right? But if it's coming out of place from like where you know, or an organic farm or some sort of co-op that where that you trust their practices, you know that you're getting like healthy, nutritious food out of a healthy, nutritious soil.
So that would be indicated. And if you maybe say you went to an organic farm and they did like a pick your own produce, and if you, you know, this doesn't sound good, but if you popped a couple things in your mouth without washing it, of course you would always pay for it first. but just for example theory here, if say you took a couple of tomatoes and you were out on an organic farm, you took a couple of tomatoes, you popped those in your mouth, that'd probably be a pretty good dosage of some soil and some environmental bacteria.
I think so. And I have yet to see a lot of research on this, but I think, and this, that reminds me of what I was going to mention earlier about just gleaning wild foods as well, right? So berries, particularly around here, you know, we see huckleberries. So when I'm on runs or up in the mountains, like it's not a lot of sustenance, but you can always, sometimes you can find huckleberries or mostly berries, I'd say. You're probably not out there eating seeds, but
no, probably most people aren't going to be as adventurous. But
also, so, there's people that you know, forage for you know, roots and pretty much like almost every part of the native plants. Like there's something you can do with it to create a tincture or a tea, or yeah, just eating it raw sometimes.
I think that's so cool. I like the idea of learning about foraging. And so I'm hoping to, if you have any experience in that or you know, got some background, I'd love to, like, at some point, pick your brain on that.
Good. Yeah, I mean, so I think the first thing is becoming familiar with what's around you, right? So recently my son started Cub Scouts. And so this past summer we were out camping and I told them that I'd be happy to lead a nature walk. And, it became, the first question was like, can I eat that? And I like being trained, well trained. I was like, don't eat anything you don't know what it is. But like these kids from particularly urban areas, or you know, they're still young, and even adults like don't know what's out there and around them. And they basically are like, don't eat anything found in nature, right? So no mushroom. But particularly for me, like I'm terrible at mushroom identification, so I don't mess around with mushrooms. Like I know some. Like people talk about certain species that are just so buttery and yummy, but they're sometimes hard to find too. So I generally stick away from mushrooms, but plants, I know plants, so I feel good ingesting pretty much anything I put in.
Wow. What about roots with plants? Do you ever dig up roots? Have you ever munched on any roots?
I don't, but there's, bulbs and different roots from, let me see. The Devil's Club, mm-hmm. pretty much the rhizome off of that was used extensively by First Peoples. Camas, really important to more of the kind of prairie ecosystem that used to be more prevalent south of us, like in these like mixed gary oak and open prairies that were left after the outwash of the glaciers. There's whole books, there's whole podcasts we can do just on like what we can eat, what we can find and eat outside.
I love that. We might have to play with that in the future, because I think that is something that I find useful for a lot of folks, because you're going to find things in nature that are going to be in pristine soils or really great soils, maybe even compared to what you can get in your own garden mm-hmm. in some of these areas. Now let's talk about some roots that we can find in our own yards. You know, if we're going to be, and I guess if you wouldn't just find it, you'd have to grow things like potatoes. Potatoes get a bad rap, right? Because they're nightshade and too many carbs and this and that. But wouldn't you think if you grew a potato in your own yard and it's a rhizome, right? It's a root. Mm-hmm. It's a tuber, technically.
Tuber.
Sorry, not a rhizome, tuber. I gotta get my technicalities right here.
Very similar, if not the same.
Well, you know, depends on who you talk to. You're being kind to me. Thank you. Some of my professors, I think, in the biology department would not be cool with that. But if you eat like a potato and say you just minimally kind of dust it off, you don't do like the full-on scrub, you don't add any of the other agents, you don't soak it a lot, would you think that you would be able to get some good nutrition, you know, in terms of good soil-based bacteria, maybe even some fungus around that? That could be beneficial?
Yeah, I think so. Particularly, I think the one thing I don't know if I'm answering your question directly, but, particularly I think a lot of people like grow, or especially in industrial agriculture, a lot of pesticides are used to control mm-hmm. pests. And, you know, one of the things that's particularly, it's pretty much very common knowledge, I think, in the health and fitness podcast, but not necessarily in the like ecology, is that, yeah, these pesticides are a no-no. Like they're particularly like glyphosate, which is a really was patented as an antimicrobial.
I did not know that.
Yes, so it's that mode of action as far as killing plants. Its mode of action is it's an amino acid inhibitor, and it's very similar in composition to glycine.
Oh,
it's crazy. Yeah. So if you ever dig into Dr. Stephanie Seneff's work, she goes into detail about about glyphosate. But as an antimicrobial, I think it's been used. But what we noticed was that there was some resistance to it. So they've seen this in like India, where it's been like the chemicals been kind of forced upon the agriculture industry there. But I think that resistance is coming from microbial resistance, probably. And microbes being like so small, and the generations of life are so quick turnover, so quickly they can adapt and evolve very quickly. And I think that's where the resistance comes from. So, essentially that's, I think, the real mechanism behind like the why pesticides can be bad, is that with this one, it would be basically sanitizing the microbial diversity within the soil. So yes, you're coming up with like a food product they're consuming that's less nutritious.
Yeah.
Because it's not growing in that rich, like, and you can supplement that with fertilizers to a certain extent to get like a bigger potato, but it's not necessarily packed with all the phytonutrients that you really want.
So if you did Miracle-Gro and glyphosate in your garden, you're not going to have much nutrition.
Yeah, and more and more, I think, I've been hearing is like people just continue to eat and eat more and more, but there's a lot to be said for nutrient-packed foods that, you know, they just have that taste, and when you get them in your mouth, I think you just, you know, but it's a lot different than, buying produce at, that store.
So ultimately, yes, commercially grown produce compared to what you might be growing in your backyard. Hopefully you're not using glyphosate and Miracle-Gro. Hopefully if you're using anything, some people don't use anything, actually minimal in my garden, but some people will use some of the probiotic combinations for fertilizer that I've seen out there. And that would make more nutritious food in terms of what you're saying, correct?
I think so.
Okay. And, you know, by the way, folks who are listening here, we're kind of in a topic that's evolving. There's not a ton of data out there in terms of what impact we can have truly on our gut microbiome by manipulating our green spaces, by manipulating what we breathe. And, you know, I'm making a joke about eating dirt, but I'm almost wondering if we might end up with certain powders and things of that nature coming in the future that are mimicking dirt to help us with our gut microbiome.
Yeah, I think there are some products out there like sprays you can put on your skin, right?
Yeah.
Probably derived from soil bacteria. And probably not too far off is something like a nasal inhaler or something, perhaps.
I think that's really
good. So you can just skip nature You don't even have to go out there and just shoot it.
That's what marketing seems to be all about, which is sad because I do think nature is important because not only do we get the microbiome aspect from nature, we get the mental. And I think that too has something to say about it because as we talked about earlier, we're talking about the lowering of the cortisol effect and how nature really does bring us back to, you know, almost set point or reset for us. Now, let's talk a little bit more, just a little bit more on gut bugs, only because I want to talk about it in the case of restoring the gut microbiome, because we talked about the sprays like Mother Earth brand and those guys in terms of sprays and a nasal spray. You might be the next patent on that. Nobody else steals it. It's Michael Steele right there.
Take it.
But in terms of restoring gut balance, because we see so much out there in terms of you need X, Y, and Z probiotic to boost your mood. You need X, Y, and Z probiotic to poop better. You need X, Y, Z probiotic for blah, blah, blah. The options are infinite. Let's talk about how do we restore gut bacteria using an ecological method. Because and this is, folks, just for some background on this podcast, this is how Michael and I decided we needed to talk. Because we were talking about how one helps to restore gut microbiomes and how we restore the gut bacteria. And in my mind, I was like, oh, duh, I have a biology background. I did all this stuff with succession and restoration. And I go, wait a minute, I'm totally throwing my whole theory out of what I know about nature just to go in someone's gut and like kill down some bugs and try to fake manipulate the gut microbiome. And honestly, it doesn't work out so well most of the time. It's a conundrum. So let's talk about this ecological restoration theory as we apply it to working on the gut microbiome.
Okay. Yeah. So as a plant ecologist, that's my official title. But really what I practice is restoration, ecological restoration. So the definition of that is assisting the recovery of an ecosystem that's been damaged, degraded, or destroyed. So that's a classical definition from the Society for Ecological Restoration. And it seems like recently ecologists have been starting to study the interactions and started to collaborate on research with healthcare practitioners and have published a few things on this. What I found most interesting was just how we define the microbiome to a certain extent and how that dictates our strategies for restoring it. So like one thing, and I don't know, I'd like to ask you this, like, do you think there's definitions of the microbiome from years past? Like, is it an organ or is it part of our immune system, or is it part of our whole biome, like of us as like a meta-organism or an ecosystem? Is it just part of us? Because like we're just over, we have more human cells in us than bacteria cells, but like not by much, right?
Yeah.
So like how have you been taught to define it? Because if it's an organ, right, I guess, is there any diseases of the microbiome?
Mm-hmm.
There is?
Yeah, you can have, and it's only like related to excess or deficiency.
Oh, okay.
So if you look at in a prairie restoration kind of model, in excess, you've got weeds.
Yeah.
In deficiency, you have a deficient organism that's more of your sustaining animal, if you will, if we're looking at animals, or sustaining plant that's going to sustain life in that ecosystem.
Oh,
so
right.
If you're deficient in certain bugs, other ones can't live.
Right.
Same kind of thing if we look out in terms of a restorative environment.
Mm-hmm.
So when I look at bugs and cells and try to think about, like, is it an organ? Nah, I wouldn't say it's an organ. I would say it's definitely ecosystem. It's almost like a symbiotic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Our bugs that live inside us signal to our cells. Our cells signal back to them. And so I'm kind of thinking, I don't want to use the word parasite because I don't think it's like that. It's not a leeching type of thing. It's symbiotic. So I don't know if I'm throwing a wrench into the whole plan here in terms of thought process,
but I
think it's symbiotic, and I think that we're working together, and I think that part of the problem we have is that too much Frankenfoods are killing our good bugs down, and I think that also not being too stressed and not taking time to take care of ourselves, we're also wiping out some of these bugs because they're species that respond to stressors in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
They don't adapt well. And so if we think of survival of the fittest and all that, unfortunately, some of our bugs are not surviving, and we're coming up with species in abundance that are not as beneficial.
Okay. Yeah. So I think for as far as like an organ perspective, like even though you may have disregarded that, but like we just can't like transplant like the microbiome, maybe to a certain extent, because that's the strategy, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes where you can like transplant like, with antibiotics, you can kind of like diminish, right?
Yes.
Like what the abundance and the composition of what you have in your gut. But then, too, the probiotic is almost like you're seeding, like from the restoration ecology perspective, it's like you're seeding it, like you're trying to, with just like throwing material at it. So, like the probiotic, we all may have taken this morning, who knows, you put it in your mouth, does it stay or does it flush out? So, but the ecosystem perspective, that's where I think restoration ecology can help inform to a certain extent. And even to a greater extent, I feel like it's almost becoming a very popular opinion that it's just like we're an ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And that my family, we were in Washington, D.C. a couple weekends ago, and we were in the Smithsonian, the Natural History Museum.
Cool.
And in the exhibit on hominid evolution and human impacts, there was this panel about how we're an ecosystem and talking about microbes.
Wow.
So it's that deep, like, and people just, you know, thousands or millions of people walk through the Smithsonian every year. And if they happen to look at that panel of thousands that are in the museum, I mean, I think they're going to take that home and just that message. But that message means, if that's our definition of our microbiome and how we interact with, the soil microbiome, let's say, it helps to dictate, that kind of dictates our strategies for restoring it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Because if we're looking at, for example, mass consumption of probiotics, because I know people who will take the probiotics and they'll drink their kefir and they'll drink their kombucha and they'll eat their sauerkraut. I mean, imagine if you took grass seed and you walked out in your front yard and your front yard wasn't really that bad. Maybe there's a patch here or there, and then you took the seed and you just started spreading it all over the front yard. Well, what's going to happen? Well, a couple things, right? Maybe you get a rainstorm right after it, because that would be my luck if I tried to do something like that. And it might wash away quite a bit of those seeds. It might wash away a lot of them if it was a big rainstorm. And so in your gut, a lot of us will take probiotics and then we'll drink a whole bunch of coffee. with the probiotics. That's like a rainstorm after putting grass seed out. So I think we have to think, for one thing, what is our objective and how are we going to come about that objective? When someone's working to restore land, we have to think about the soil. And so that's your gut lining. Is your gut lining healthy enough? If you're eating crap food and you're taking probiotics, you're not getting the full benefit out of your probiotics because your soil is not good at that point. Because how are you, your gut's going to be inflamed. So we have to think about the soil. We have to think about pH and just environment as a whole. The more stressed someone is, the more that that gut's going to have trouble. Kind of like a patch of land in the middle of an urban environment. People are maybe cutting across it because it's a shortcut from A to B. You know, maybe there's just like one side has a big building and so there's so much shade that nothing really grows in certain sections, or maybe, you know, vice versa, there's just too much light. So we also have to think about the environment as a whole. So the soil, then the pH, the, you know, how much sun. And in that case, what I'm talking about with sun and light and that in our gut, I'm talking about how much stress are you putting on your body? I'm also talking about how much in terms of actual issues are you causing with dehydration? You don't drink water, you just drink maybe soda and juices. Now we've got another issue in terms of the gut. So that one, then if you look at like the whole picture in terms of what species do you actually have there. I do like the tests in terms of biome and things of that nature to know what's there, just so you know what you're doing.
I'm waiting for mine.
Yes.
I bought it on sale, so I think subsequently it just creates this backlog of everyone.
Like, yeah, it is on sale.
Everyone submitted their poop at the same time, so it's just like, I don't know, I've been waiting. I thought it was going to be 2 weeks, and now it's like probably 2 months.
Dang it.
Well, so as a baseline, right, like I want to know like what I have, right? Like how many species do I have? Do you want to bet? I don't know.
Oh, my God.
80? 90?
Maybe. Maybe. Okay. I mean,
but I want to double it, right?
What you want is as much diversity as you can possibly get, like a diversified portfolio.
Okay. Like a portfolio. That's good. Okay. Yeah. So as far as like a for restoration, what we often, you know, 'cause we start as place that's a piece of land, that's been degraded, damaged, or destroyed. I know those are kind of, those are loaded.
That's everybody's gut.
Those are loaded topics, but degraded, like a degraded land would be somewhere where soil has been moved and just like laid on top of another spot. And then just like stuff, like a community of vegetation just started to assemble on it naturally, right? You know, so so we take land that looks like that and we have this idea of what we want to create. So in my life, we want to create some sort of forest that was very similar, perhaps, to what has always kind of evolved here in the Pacific Northwest in the Puget Sound. So we talk about a very common topic element to restoration is like a reference ecosystem, right? So it's either like a physical site that like looks awesome. It's like, this is what we want. And that's analogous, I think, to like the microbiome with the research that's been done looking at like indigenous communities and their gut, right? It's like, is that attainable even, right? So that's where I think the reference ecosystem thing has been criticized to a certain extent. So, but also if you don't have a site that's analogous to what you want to shoot for, you can also come up just with like random history and information from like aerial images or other surveys that have been done in the area to come up with like a reference, because you need, like, you know where you start, you know what you want to shoot for, and you can put the ecosystem on a certain trajectory using certain activities. So in my case, like when we're killing weeds, we have certain methods that we use to kill the weeds. So like the non-native invasive species that we think are undesirable for whatever reason. We won't get into that. But so yeah, we can pull things out by hand. We can use glyphosate. We can weed whack things. And then we can reseed an area or replant an area with a desirable, in my case, vegetation. In our case, we use like dozens of species, upwards of like 100 species probably every year.
Wow.
So trees and shrubs and ground covers, so that provide different structures. So like ground covers that just grow down low, and shrubs that can grow up over your head, and then trees, which are incredibly long-lived, that are there like way past us for, you know, and they'll be there for the next generation. So in that way, we can, in a very short period of time, we can push like an ecosystem to a certain extent, kind of assist the recovery and put it on a trajectory to meet our goals. So I don't know if there's any parables to kind of microbiome rewilding but I think there's some similarities.
No, I think I absolutely agree. I think the biggest thing that I would kind of add to it in terms of what you've mentioned is the ecosystems that each individual person has is unique to them. It's unique to their own environment. So meaning like Puget Sound, what we're going to restore in Puget Sound is not the same thing you're going to restore in the prairie land of Illinois or Wisconsin. Completely mm-hmm. different. And so I want everyone to keep in mind that they're unique. And so there's a lot of labs and there's a lot of information out there online that's a one-size-fits-all approach. I don't think that the gut is a one-size-fits-all approach. Now, in terms of weeding and feeding and seeding, these are things that I think should happen. I think we need to really step back from the whole kill all the bugs down and like launch like this huge war, because I've done it myself. I've done it on my gut, you know, on my own. I've done it to other patients, and I don't think it works out well. What I found to be best is to slowly start to do the weed and feed process and reintegrate while always thinking about the soil and what kind of food's going in. Mm-hmm.
So everything from the outside, like when we're born, mm-hmm. is the microbiome populated by just things from the environment, or do you think we inherit any of it? Because I feel like maybe there's some new research out that like actually some of the microbes like transfer like to the baby from the mom. Is that a real thing?
Absolutely. So supposedly amniotic fluid and what we're sitting in mom's belly is sterile, supposedly. I don't know. I at this point, we have data that says it's sterile. But as soon as baby comes out of mom through the vaginal canal, if baby is born that way, yes, that's where we get inoculated mm-hmm. with everything and anything. What's in the hospital room? What's in the environment? You know, one of my friends said that she wants her baby born out in the woods. As long as things are going well in the pregnancy, I think that's actually a kind of cool idea, because now we've got soil floating around and things. Other people out there are probably cringing at me saying that right now, but hey, the more you can get exposed to at an earlier stage, the better. In terms of C-section births, I think they're not seeded as well, because mm-hmm. you're not going through mom's canal. You're just getting exposed. You know, your first breath of air is what you're getting exposed to in that hospital environment. And hospitals, mm-hmm. as we know, can float two different ways. They're extremely sterile in some cases and very dirty in others. Mm-hmm. So folks having C. diff, maybe not necessarily the diarrhea type, but having underlying C. diff, I have some arguments in terms of how that gets seeded in terms of C-section babies. Now, there's no data on that right now, so anyone out there is going to go and dive into that. This is me. That's no one else. It's just me. Well, there probably are other people, but it's just me thinking it in terms of what happens. So, yes, the way that we're born is it will make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, and then over time, we just acquire new microbes and seed our microbiome through just environmental exposure, right?
Yep, absolutely. Okay. How much we're outside, how much, you know, what we're eating in terms of fresh foods, things of that nature.
So what about dairy? As we were talking about, like, do all these microbes that we're seeding, potentially, I guess, we're feeding or seeding into ourselves, like with probiotics, like the lactobacillus or the bifidobacterium, they're very common in probiotics. Like, are those, like, what's their origin?
So those actually do come from dairy. They're isolates. So they're extracted from dairy products. And I think the idea that with all of this and where it got started with probiotics, a lot of it came from how dairy is beneficial, how mother's milk is beneficial to us. There's other components with colostrum and things of that nature, like what's in it, the good fats, the immune system benefits, but also talking about how we've got different bugs that come from mom. Breastfeeding in particular, now we've got skin bugs on mom as well. So there's so many different ways that we can get into bacteria. Now, most probiotics that you're going to find on the market now have been extracted from a dairy source grown on something of that nature. Now, lactobacillus can also come. So this is a wrench in the thing. Lactobacillus also can come from sauerkraut. It can also be a soil-based type of thing. So it's a multifaceted probiotic, which I would need like 4 hours, I think, to go into all the details of that guy. But, you know, it's a very sensitive probiotic though. And I think it's time to give some actionable items for our listeners based off of this podcast, because people are probably like, okay, we've heard a ton about restoration, we've heard a ton about probiotics and things of that nature. What the heck do we do?
Just do all the things.
Do it all. No, right now. No, so let's talk about it. So we've got a list here. We got 6 things for you guys. So number one, Michael.
Number one. Actually, number one and number two really come from Dr. Maya Chitrit-Klein, who wrote The Dirt Cure. So I'm starting to dig into that book, but I think it's a pretty solid resource. But number one and number two are just get exposure by going outside, and that means anywhere. I think if it's the small green space, if it's the big spot, if it means going camping, if it means going to the beach, you know, whatever makes you feel good, I think there's probably some underlying importance to that, just going with your instinct or your intuition. And microbes might be at play. They might not be the whole picture. The other one is eating foods from healthy soils, because we know that the healthy soils engenders diversity, and they give you you're helping to reseed your microbiome by eating things that come out of healthy soils where you've known how they've been managed.
So that would be something like an organic farm, things of that nature.
Of course, yeah. We're growing it yourself.
Yep.
Yeah. Number three is, in the work that I do, we host restoration work parties, and that's digging in the dirt alongside with your neighbors, meeting new people. We pull weeds and plant trees. There's also trail work parties. And I think a lot of there might be like a local nonprofit group, or the city may host these nearby to you. My program in particular is called Green Seattle Partnership, and we work with thousands, upwards of like 15,000 people a year. And we just, last year, we surpassed our 1 millionth hour of volunteer time. So it's a pretty key aspect, we think, to life in the city, of creating kind of a healthy environment while getting out there and being physically fit, building healthy people and then strong communities as well. So I feel like that can be a new experience for some people. It's a good habit to get into. You know, we talked about gardening a little bit before. I think composting is really where it's at. And even if people don't have a backyard and they just can start with a planter box, I think it's a good start. But like saving those food scraps and actually composting yourself, like that's where the action is. That's where the biological action is.
Oh yeah.
In the garden.
For sure. Cause now you're making your dirt right there, and you know what's going into your dirt. And then later you can have a planter box. That's going to be some amazing plants, and you know, amazing. And if maybe you're like, okay, I want to make some compost because I'm part of a community garden, that's a whole nother thing to consider as well.
I think tying this into the phenology of where we are in the year, in the fall, lots of leaves are turning color. If you live in a place where there's trees, trees are turning color. Those leaves are falling. I raked in blue leaves a lot the last couple of weeks. But we talked about some actionable items and things that Dr. Krauss really talks about a lot is having fun, which, so you can rake those leaves up, jump as deep into the pile as you can get. But I think this also, what you'll notice is that there's smells, and those bacteria that were on the leaves, you know, are falling, I mean, you know, decomposed by additional bacteria and fungi. So you're exposing, you will be getting some exposure in addition to fun.
Absolutely. Rolling down hills. I also mentioned that, you know, who hasn't rolled down a hill? Like, I mean, when you're a kid, most kids do that. But, like, who's done that in their, like, adult years? It's super fun.
Need to do it at least once a summer. Yeah.
Absolutely. Then the last thing.
Is test and retest. So from the restoration ecology perspective, we usually take some baseline of data about what the ecosystem looks like. We do our thing. We experiment. Kill weeds, plant trees, and then after a certain period of time, we take data again based on, usually for us, it's like the structure and the composition, and it could even be like, you know, the microscopic microbes that are living in the soil and see how they've changed over time. And so you have this before and after snapshot, and then take that information and adapt and develop sort of a course of action moving forward.
I think that's huge. I think using tests like Viome, there's also SmartGut, but either one, just keeping consistent with what testing, you know, material you use, I think at least 6 months in between will give you a really good sense of if all your outdoor activity and working on maybe some fermented foods, things of that nature, if you're into that, you can see what kind of change you've made and, you know, kind of go from there. All right. Well, thanks, Michael, for coming on. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's been a dream of mine.
Awesome.
You know, I've actually just been listening for a little over a year, and so you're on my regular go-to favorite podcast, so it's been really great. Huh. And for a while, I was like, when she talks about plants a little bit, she dips into it a bit, but I knew you're like into, I felt like you were, could get you into the topic a little deeper.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate that. So folks, you can get all the notes from this podcast at thehealthfixpodcast.com. I'll have it all listed out there. I'll also give you some links in terms of how to find Michael over at the Tree Hugger podcast going forward. And I'll definitely have him back on. So stay tuned for more fun with Michael. All right, folks, have a great day, whatever you're doing. Hey everybody, Dr. Janine Krause here. If you liked what you heard today, then head over to drjkrausend.com to find my free resources and information to know when I post something new that's juicy that you might want to check out. Plus, head over to where you get your podcasts and like, subscribe, and write a review to help get the word out about me and help others at the same time to find me. It really does help, and I really appreciate all of your reviews.